Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So this incident that happened around Michigan Avenue over the weekend, video of it went viral.
And we tweeted it out. I saw that you tweeted it and others.
Guy that was in a car that crashed in the loop near Michigan Avenue, got out and ran, and some good Samaritan, dare I say.
Wasn't he awesome?
Pushed him down, then tripped him, or tripped him, then pushed him down until cops could come and arrest him. It was quite a scene if you were window shopping on the Mag Mile this weekend.
Scared the bejesus out of it. Actually, he did like a leg sweep the first time. And then he fell, and then he leg-sweeped him again, and the dude almost hit his head on a pole. It was fantastic.
Thank you, Sensei.
Great vigilante.
Yeah.
Vigilante, excuse me.
Uh-huh. Sweep the leg. Get him a
he
body
did.
Bag.
It was good.
So the question, of course, is, well, so there was a car that crashed near Michigan Avenue, and then the guy got out and ran. Well, what's the backstory? Chicago Press Corps didn't have it. CWB Chicago has the backstory, the full backstory. And it is a case study in everything that is wrong with enforcing the law or not doing so in Chicago. The guy that ran,
Yeah. You'll
be surprised to learn he is known to police. He was charged in March of 2017 with killing two people and injuring a third during a shootout authorities said was the result of an attempt to steal marijuana. He was also shot during the incident. This is 5 years ago. Initially held without bail in that case, later released on electronic monitoring to await trial on 140 felony counts.
Oh my God.
By the way, one day we're going to have a discussion about this overcharging nonsense to 140 felony counts. He goes to trial then for 30. So, but I digress because that's not the important point here. David Brown, exactly 1 year ago, after July ended with more than 100 people murdered in Chicago, he identified this guy who was, you know, tripped and taken into custody on Michigan Avenue on Saturday. He and then was charged back in 2017 with killing two people. David Brown said of this guy, if you release him, who was charged with two murders and an attempted murder and continued to commit crime while in jail, we're going to run in place as a city. David Brown, the CPS superintendent, quoting him, too many violent repeat offenders are being released back into these communities, creating a sense of lawlessness and no consequences of their behavior, making for a dangerous environment. He said that in BBM a year ago, on BBM a year ago. So apparently the prosecution didn't put together a particularly case because he was tried for 30 felony counts, you know, because he killed two people and attempted to kill others. And he was found not guilty on every charge, including 8 counts of murder.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
They had witnesses who didn't stand up under cross divine from CWB Chicago's reporting on it. So he's tried by a jury of his peers and he's turned out. So he's back on the streets. And 5 years later, he hit the street near Michigan and Harrison. There's something else, though, about this case. That's not it. When the cops got to the car, he was a passenger in the car. When they took him into custody, took the driver into custody. Cops found a blue book bag on the front passenger seat where this guy had been sitting. They found a loaded handgun with the auto-fire switch, an extended magazine, along with bottles of drugs and about $8,000 worth of pot. Another bag located behind the driver's seat contained another $8,000 worth of pot. Prosecutors charged the driver with aggravated fleeing, possession of cannabis, driving on a suspended license. Possession of cannabis is still a charge? What's the point?
Why? It's legal here.
They charged this guy in question, featured in the video, acquitted on multiple counts of murder 5 years ago. They charged him with possession of cannabis and possessing a controlled substance, but they didn't charge him on the gun. A 40 cal with an extended magazine and auto switch. The judge, Cook County judge, Marubio, why isn't this gun charged? 40 caliber handgun with extended magazine and auto switch. The prosecutor replied, the gun charge was reviewed and decisions were made at the time not to charge that gun. The judge, but is he then charged with the drugs in the bag? That is my understanding. After a long silence, the judge offered a confounded okay. He only has two misdemeanor convictions in his background, including a mob action charge. He's out on a $1,000 bail. The driver, convicted of two gun felonies and felony misuse of a credit card, $2,500.
That's it.
So as the headline nicely encapsulates, murder electronic monitoring, Chicago's top cop, an acquittal, guns, pot, a viral video, Lollapalooza, questions about prosecutorial decisions, and a dumbfounded judge. There's justice in Cook County. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Tell me again about your focus on violent crime. Tell me again about getting guns off the street, certainly out of the hands of people who commit crimes with them or intend to. Did he have his FOID card on him? Did he have a CCW license? Those would be some interesting questions.
Yeah.
That's not what they said. When the judge asked, why didn't you charge the gun? Decisions were made. They made themselves? The decisions make themselves? Who made them? And on what basis? That's the appropriate follow-up.
But we would have thought we were going after guns, a big gun buyback program that's going to be happening and all that. Why wouldn't they charge them for the weapons violation?
You need some judges. I mean, it's fine she asked the question. She needs to probe a little bit deeper so you get the state's attorney's office on the record. Since Kim Fox won't come on the record unless
she's too busy accepting resignations.
She's compelled to by, a Jussie Smollett case. Which does bring us to the resignation of Jim Murphy.
The 235th person to resign from her office.
Jim Murphy was prosecutor there for 29 years. He wrote last week in his resignation letters, fare thee well note, I cannot continue to work for an administration I no longer respect. Give an example of why he does not respect this administration, meaning Kim Fox. A few months ago, I was summoned into a meeting with the state's attorney so she could criticize some bond hearings I did. One involved a massive shootout. The other involved a woman who was walking to the store when she was gunned down in crossfire. Bond hearings involve gun possession charges only. The state's attorney communicated that she was upset because a headline in the newspaper read, quote, man won't face murder charge under the Safety Act, unquote. State attorney voiced her concern with the headline and the heat she was getting from her backers and never voiced any concern over the fact that this woman was shot and killed simply walking to the store and nobody was going to face a murder charge. This is what is wrong with this administration. I've seen it day after day. How many more mass shootings do there have to be before something is done? The administration is more concerned with political narratives and agendas than with victims and prosecuting violent crime. That is why I can no longer stay.
He said, I can no longer work for this administration. I have zero confidence in leadership.
Oh, that's the question, isn't it? That's the question. How many more mass shootings do there have to be before something is done? In other words, how much worse does it need to get? What's it going to take? David in Winnetka.
Yeah, hi. Good morning, guys. My over the weekend, my friends, I'm up in Lake Forest, they let their children go down to Lala, let him take the train, you know, no warning, no this, no that. Just go ahead. Well, on the train, the gal, 16 or 17, she gets her backpack cut off. You know, the perpetrators try to cut her backpack off and steal her possessions. And in the melee of it, she gets stabbed in the arm pretty bad. And the so I guess there's medical at Lala. They fix her up, do whatever. And then the parents let the kid get back on the train after the show and come home. My question is, how are these parents letting their kids go down to Chicago? I can see O'Carry, and I don't want to go down to Chicago. It's insane.
Mm-hmm.
It's their choice.
Thanks for the call, David. Yeah, and the incidents like that don't get reported either.
No, because she didn't. You know, she just went to the medical tent. She didn't have to go to the hospital.
And we heard from one of our colleagues that one of the ways that they were trying to minimize the crime associated with the congregants at Lala over the weekend was to funnel them through one precinct and then distribute them
to different districts.
To different districts, so that it didn't appear that there was a concentration of criminal activity at Lala. I mean, if you're going to charge these guys who were apparently joyriding in and around Lala with cannabis possession, you could have charged how many ever tens of thousands of people that were at Lala over the weekend. The whole thing is, I mean, it's not a joke because it's too serious, because there are lives on the line every day and in every way. But, I mean, I just, you know, Jim Murphy, the prosecutor who resigned, 29 years on the job.
Very well respected, by the way.
Is asking the same question that everybody who is not asking it should be. Lee and Hammond, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, guys. You know, the reason that there's no big groundswell of citizens demanding something be done about all this lunacy, I talk to friends of mine all the time that said they refuse to even think about these things. They want to imagine that life is just fine and that they're enjoying their life, and they don't want to think about these things, and they just try to put them in the back of their mind and not even concentrate on what's going on here. And as long as that goes on, this is never going to get any better, because what you need is citizens in this community demanding that these idiots do something about these. This is nationwide, you know, of course.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Lee. Yeah,
Democratic-run cities.
I know, the news is icky.
It's uncomfortable. And that's, never forget that lady after that mass shooting in Boys Town who said, and we played it here, I go downstairs and I sit in my basement and I just pretend that none of this is happening. That is so indicative of a Chicagoan.
A lot of magical thinking out there. By the way, George Soros came out of the shadows to pen an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal over the weekend, defending his decision to support prosecutors like Kim Fox and saying he's not going to stop. And if so, there you go. If the residents of places like Cook County don't stop him, then he won't stop, and it won't stop.
America First with Sebastian Gorka, today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. A British Army veteran was arrested by five police officers who showed up to his home. Five police officers showed up to the home of a British Army veteran who's a senior citizen at this point. The charge was
what?
Causing someone anxiety because of a Facebook post he made that was termed homophobic by the police. He posted a meme on Facebook arranging four trans flags into a swastika. And then this happened.
I care about you. So a man is a perfectly peaceful war veteran is being handcuffed for a Facebook post by a politically motivated police force. He's being handcuffed. He's not resisted. He's not done anything. This is a man who served our country, and you people are a disgrace serving an ideology that you're doing. This is an ordinary human being.
I think you're tyrants. I think you should not be doing this. You're infringing my human rights and my freedom of speech on the Section 8 and 10 of the ECHR.
You have to give him a speech.
Yeah.
They don't care. They just don't care. They don't care. They don't care. They're brown shirts.
Oh, no.
Is this the Gestapo?
This is how it began. This is the Gestapo, the Stasi, the Cheka, every political police force has ever existed.
That's exactly what people in occupied Nazi Germany and whatnot.
We're in 1937, 38, pretty much.
All they're doing is proving the point.
Yeah,
they're proving the point. And they're all going to be famous as a result of it. Bullying, harassment, intimidation.
Do you have numbers written down somewhere of people you want to call?
They're in my head.
Perfect.
Yeah, I'm a British Army veteran. Okay. Yeah, you should not be doing this to me. Okay. I expect my freedom of speech. Yeah, this is wrong. This is absolutely wrong. Look what you're doing in front of all my neighbours. Really? Seriously?
For a Facebook post. You didn't need to have to come and knock on his door on a Sunday morning and intimidate him.
Now it's wait here so my neighbours can see me.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Is this the Gestapo, the British Army veteran asked? What has gone wrong in our country? Under Article 10 of the Human Rights Act of 1998, everyone has the right to freedom of expression. That's a quote in Britain. The law goes on to say the freedom may be subject to formalities, conditions, restrictions, or penalties as are prescribed by law and necessary in a democrat society. A number of different British laws outlaw hate speech. That's defined as threatening, abusive, or insulting words or behaviors that cause or is likely to cause another person harassment, alarm, or distress. This law also includes language deemed to incite racial or religious hatred, as well as hatred on the grounds of sexual orientation and language that encourages terrorism.
Did you see the flags? I don't see that the swastika in there, but that's not threatening. And there's incidents, you know, where there's been burglaries and domestic break-ins that don't get police response, yet they've responded to an incident on social media.
Five police officers showed up to this Army veteran's home, who, as far as I understand, is otherwise served Britain honorably and has had no run-ins with the law, to arrest him for this Facebook post.
Do you think and this again, is coming here?
Well, and again, I mean, you have, as he, you heard him quote, you have the right to freely express yourself in Britain. It's not quite as strong as our First Amendment protections. But do you think the left in this country is any different than the left in Britain that passed laws that criminalize speech? Have you seen what's happened on college campuses? Have you seen the enforcement of thought crimes, the prosecution of quote-unquote thought or speech crimes in public and private settings? Maybe not exactly at the hands of police, but your 15-degree dial turn away in this country. If the left had their way, you think they wouldn't be happy to arrest and prosecute people like this British Army veteran for hate speech? When you behave like totalitarian, somebody is going to call you a totalitarian. They're describing your behavior, not harassing or threatening you. And if you find that anxiety inducing, well, then maybe you should. Maybe that's time for some reflection on your conduct, not your identity. This is pretty serious stuff. I don't know how to bring this home. We've been trying for years and years on this show to bring this home to people. And I guess all you can do is highlight these grievous affronts on college campuses, grievous transgressions of our cultural norms, if you believe in living in a free society. A lot of people don't anymore. In corporate settings, what the left has proposed at the federal, state, and local levels in this country, and incidents in the West that should serve as cautionary tales for what absolutely could happen here. Now, we have some checks and balances that the Brits don't have, and we have a balance of power that the Brits don't have, namely, right now, based on its composition, the Supreme Court of the United States. That's one backstop. But, you know, that backstop is subject to, God's will in terms of how long justices will live and have capacity to tackle cases, and the political vagaries of the time, who's making appointments, who's in charge of confirmations. But the ground is crumbling underneath us.
Turnkey.pro answer line. You can also text us at 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
The irony of this arrest, speaking of the transitarians, the Tavistock Gender Identity Development Center, England's hub for child gender reassignment, has been ordered closed down. A investigation into the Tavistock Gender Identity Development Service, the Orwellian institutions and actions by the state abound in the UK. And by the way, where are the British conservatives? Where are the Tories tackling this abuse of police power imposed on this British Army veteran? This should be a national conversation in the UK right now. You dispense with the royal welfare queens. Focus on your average citizens and their rights, particularly those who served your country honorably. For goodness sakes, the Tavistock Gender Identity Development Service, subjected to an investigation as a result of whistleblowers, parents, and patients blaming it for rushing children, particularly girls, into medical treatment for suspected gender dysphoria, is to now be shut down by the spring of 2023, so a year from now, less, after the pediatrician leading the investigation declared some of her recommendations early, most notably that the Gender Identity Development Service is, quote, not a safe or viable long-term option for its patients and should be replaced. Anybody want to tackle that? The identitarian goon squad? Somebody in the D.C. press corps want to track down the good doctor, Rachel Levine, number two at HHS, or Sam Britton over there handling our nuclear waste at Department of Energy. Or the big guy, for that matter, since they're all identitarian hacks, too. Ask him about this. Since Rachel Levine is out and proud about puberty blockers.
Which you can get at Planned Parenthood now.
Of course you can. Puberty blockers being, among other interventions, medical interventions to mutilate, being destructive. Not just what Tavistock was doing, but we know from research we talked about last week that the use of puberty blockers is believed to induce neurological problems in the kids.
You could go
who
blind.
Take them.
Blind. Blurry vision and loss of vision.
And because this is so politicized, as everything is now, why? Because all roads run through the identitarian way station. Some Tavistock clinicians, this is in the UK, blamed for converting youngsters who were probably same-sex attracted into thinking they were actually trans. You know, there's unpacking these statements. The Telegraph over in the UK is now looking back on 18 years of whistleblowing and criticisms. The NHS, their National Health Service, their version of Obamacare, a little bit more aggressive, a little bit longer standing. They did through the front door what we did through the back door, takeover, government takeover of healthcare services in this country. The NHS, and actually I prefer their more Orwellian acronym, NICE, should be a little have a nice day smiley face as their logo, resisted all attempts to make it change, the Tavistock Gender Identity Development Service, all the way up to the High Court in the UK. 18 years now, the Telegraph is looking back. Oh, I can't wait to, and I'm sure we'll be horrified to learn what they find. Because you're not supposed to talk about unfortunate outcomes when our political agenda is on the line, you see. And so it'll be interesting to see how this British Army veteran story is treated. Oh, and this can't happen here. Grace Church School in Manhattan. Grace Church School. Church. It's an Episcopal school.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. Might as well be your church. Their Pride Chapel. Grace Church, by the way, is Grace Church School, like $50,000 a year, maybe more, private school. That's where our friend Paul Rossi, the math teacher, taught, who was fired, and then he went public, and then he was fired. He went public saying, they are telling me I have to treat my students different based on their race. I will not do that. That's the enlightenment of the identitarians. Paul Rossi, math teacher. Telling me I have to treat my students differently based on their race. I won't do it. You're fired. Prestigious Grace Church School. The kids of the creme de la creme of New York society. Here's their event at their Pride Chapel.
Oh my.
Some dude in his rainbow t-shirt speaking in front of the altar in church, Pride Chapel, and introducing...
It was a drag show at their chapel.
Introducing
service.
Britta Filter. Britta Filter, come on down.
Her name is Britta Filter, and she is the Queen of New York! Yes!
And the parishioners, congregants, I should say, of Grace Church Pride Chapel, the congregants.
Pre-K through 12th grade.
The congregants standing up and applauding as this pig, Britta Filter, prances down the aisle, scantily clad in her, you know, pre-striptease outfit. Him. This dude. Pig.
Well, students who attend Grace Church are required to go to chapel services at least once a week. through eighth grade. So that's who was there.
Yeah.
And then some upperclassmen.
It's fascinating. They have to go to chapel services so they can be entertained by this pig, this dude, scantily clad dude, traipsing down the middle of the church to their wild applause.
Yeah. And one kid told LifeSite News that they felt pressured to play along with this drag show at their chapel service. Quote, I wondered, is this really happening in a chapel?
It's really happening.
Then they should get up, form a solidarity, get up and fight back.
Yeah, it's really happening.
It's yeah, because you're a part of it.
It's demonic. Is this resonating? Too afraid to address it, are we? How about this exchange? The kids of the creme de la creme of New York society. Woo! Look at the dancing pig. Monster. Sentimental barbarians beget sentimental barbarians. Matt Walsh's documentary.
Have you seen that yet? I gotta watch it.
What is a woman? You remember these exchanges? We play them. Just remind you of one of them. This is who you're dealing with. This exchange, Matt Walsh interviewing Dr. Michelle Forcier, assistant professor of pediatrics at Brown University, Ivy League. Assistant professor of pediatrics at Brown.
Male gametes. That's what makes me male.
No, your sperm don't make you male.
Then what does?
It's a constellation.
In reality, in truth, okay?
Whose truth are we talking about?
The same truth that says we're sitting in this room right now, you and I.
No, you're not listening.
If I see a chicken laying eggs and I say that's a female chicken laying eggs, did I assign female or am I just observing a physical reality that's happening in the world?
Does a chicken have gender identity? Does a chicken cry?
Well,
does a chicken commit suicide? Let's frame it because you're trying.
A chicken has sex like any biological organism.
A chicken has an assigned gender, but a chicken doesn't have a gender identity.
So we assign female to chickens when they lay eggs?
We assume they're female if they lay eggs.
What came first, the chicken or the gender identity? Matt Walsh better not go across the pond to the UK. Could be arrested.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Well. Border security is back in the discussion. Seems appropriate. It's only back in the discussion, though, because you're hearing complaints from New York City Mayor Eric Adams and from D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser about the illegal immigrants that have been sent to D.C. and New York.
They called out the National Guard in D.C.
In part by the federal government, in part by when it comes to D.C., the state of Texas, state of Arizona, because the federal government is allowing so many illegal immigrants into the local communities in those border states, say, well, if you think it's no big deal, then we'll send them to your doorstep in D.C. and see how you like it. It's your responsibility to make decisions about people trying to gain entry into this country. So here, you go ahead and make them locally.
Yeah, and they don't like it. So they're fighting back. They need help. This is wrong. But that's what the mayors of El Paso, El Centro, Nogales, they've had to deal with this their whole lives. So suck, you let this happen, so now you're going to feel what it's like. We're going to take it to you.
Fox News's Peter Ducey queried Quadruple Threat, Karine Jean-Pierre, KJP, about it. And this was that exchange.
The D.C. mayor sent the White House a letter asking for National Guard help with migrants that have been bused here from Texas and Arizona. Is the president going to approve that request for the National Guard?
So As to your question on the National Guard, I refer you to the Department of Defense. They will have that answer for you. We have been in regular touch with Mayor Bowser and her team. And I said this before. I said this last week about Republicans using migrants as a political tool. And that is shameful, and that is just wrong. There is a process in place for managing migrants at the border. This is not it, what they're doing currently. That includes expelling migrants as required by court order under Title 42, transferring them to ICE custody, or placing them in the care of local NGOs as they await further processing. Again, so what Republicans are doing, the way that they're meddling in the process and using migrants as a political pawn is just wrong.
So the White House's preference would be for small towns in Texas and Arizona to have to take care of these migrants rather than a large metropolitan city like Washington, D.C.
That is not what I said.
That is
not
what I said.
Yeah, they are. They're sending migrants to big cities on purpose, using them as a political ploy.
So if they don't go to big cities, where should they
go? There's a process. I just laid it out.
There's a process. And they come to a big city, and now the mayor says she needs the National Guard.
That's because Republicans are using, they're using migrants who are coming here for, who knows, because they're dealing with humanitarian issues back in their country. They're coming here for a better life, and they are being used, Peter. They're being used by Republican governors. That is what's happening.
Does any of this just make the president want to say, this is causing a lot of burdens on small cities, big cities, maybe I should just close the border?
What I'm saying is what Republicans are doing is wrong.
Of course, right. All I have to offer is that Republicans are using the people that we use as mascots in a shameful way. There's a process. No, I know, KJP. There's a process. There's a process that resulted in the last fiscal year of 2 million people trying to gain entry into this country illegally and 600,000 being released into this country, even though they're here illegally.
But they have cell phones to track them. Yeah.
There's your process.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
And interestingly, some of those massive numbers of people trying to gain entry into this country and doing so illegally do so in the Yuma, Arizona area near Morales Dam. This is the third busiest illegal crossing site along the U.S.-Mexico border. Only the third busiest. And the third busiest in the first 6 months of this year, Border Patrol agents have stopped more than 160,000. That's the third busiest.
Then what's the busiest?
And you have, Andrew Clyde, Republican from Georgia, notes, President Biden's approval rating among Latinos at 26%. And now all of a sudden, the combination of what's happening at the border, what's happening in major cities like D.C. and New York City that relates to the same issue. Now all of a sudden, you're quietly completing the wall that Trump started near Morales Dam in Arizona. Isn't that interesting? This is after the big guy defiantly said, no walls will be built. No partially completed sections will be completed.
Well, the day he took office, remember, besides, you know, getting rid of the Keystone Pipeline, he stopped construction on the border wall.
And since
a big pronouncement.
And since Fox News' Peter Ducey seems to be the only one interested in covering this story, well, you have Peter Ducey again querying KJP on it.
Why is the Biden administration building a border wall in Arizona?
So we are not finishing the wall. We are cleaning up the mess the prior administration left behind in their failed attempt to build a wall.
What? They get rid of some construction items that they were using to build the wall and sold that off, by the way, for 25% of its value. Yeah. That's they're cleaning up the mess.
Yeah.
She's out of her mind.
Walls are bad. That's what she said. She went on to say, we don't believe in walls. Okay.
But they're building one.
Because I know there's no such
words
thing as...
Words are hard. Walls are bad.
There's no such thing as an illegal person. Yeah. Right. No, there is such a thing, though, as a person being in a place illegally. And that's what we're talking about.
I think they should send everybody to, you know, sanctuary cities, sanctuary states.
Andy Biggs,
ship them all over.
Andy Biggs, Republican congressman from Arizona, about the wall being completed, or I'm sorry, cleaned up. Morales Dam gets a lot of traffic, but this is an election year kind of symbol for them. That's all it is, referring to the completion. However, Biggs foresaw that if the wall is constructed near the dam, many of the estimated 1,000 illegal immigrants per day flooding into Yuma will simply cross into the Cocopa Indian Reservation. Okay. I mean, he knows the topography better than I do, but the bottom line is what we're experiencing, and now it's being felt in big cities. And because it's being felt in Washington, D.C. and New York City, and they're making noise about it, now it's attracting attention. So good on Abbott, governor of Texas, good on Ducey, governor of Arizona, for not using these people in a shameful way, saying the same things that Bowser and Adams are saying. Well, we can't handle this influx. It's not our responsibility, oh, by the way, so you handle it, because they shouldn't be in this country illegally. People shouldn't be in this country illegally. There's a sort of a first principle. And if you can't start from that premise, then we got a real problem. And it's not just Republicans, shameful Republicans saying it. It's New York City Mayor Eric Adams and D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser, too, isn't it? Dave in Wakanda, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yes, good morning. I have, you know, Peter Ducey does a great job. I wish he would have followed up by saying that the president has illegally not followed our laws to allow these people into our country. That's one. The second one is he has put them on planes, trains, and buses and spread them throughout the United States. How is that different than Abbott sending them to Washington, D.C.?
That's no different. Yeah, right. I mean, yeah,
exactly.
I hear you. I hear you. Thanks for the call, Dave. Yeah, right. It's no different. And by the way, that is relevant in this sanctuary city, county, state in which we reside, lest you forget. Lest you forget the stories of Denny McCann and Jeannie Brady, two Illinois residents, law-abiding residents, U.S. citizens here legally, killed by people who were here illegally. And we're allowed to flee because we don't cooperate with ICE. That's just two examples. But I want to put real names and real stories to the policy. We don't cooperate with ICE, and we celebrate our lack of cooperation with ICE. Well, just like we celebrate our general lack of enforcement of the law, as we were talking about early in the program. And that will happen. There will be more angel moms and dads created because of the lawlessness at the border, no different than the lawlessness in the city of Chicago. The attitude isn't any different either. It's just a slightly different law enforcement challenge. And it's one, a responsibility that resides solely with the feds, whereas, of course, local law enforcement is mainly a state and local issue. But the principles at stake are the same. You either have the rule of law and you're interested in living up to the first responsibility of government at every level, or you don't. And the left's position on that issue could not be any clearer. Even as they do things to try to minimize the consequences of their policy choices, like finish construction of the wall in Yuma.
Well, I just, you know, took issue with her saying, quadruple threat, I should say, saying that Republican governors are using them. What do you think the Democratic Party is doing? Using them. They're using them as well. They want them to become constituents. We'll let you in, but vote Democrat.
Well, and
they're recruiting people.
I'm sure Governor Abbott and Governor Ducey would prefer not to have to bus anybody anywhere. I'm sure they would prefer to have people orderly in attempt to enter this country legally in an orderly fashion, which is the responsibility of the federal government. So I concede the point that most of the people that want to come to this country want a better life. And again, I'm very sympathetic. I'm a pro-immigration kind of guy, pro-legal immigration kind of guy, for people that believe in the principles of this country and want to contribute to it and assimilate here and live a better life. I get it. And I'm supportive, but I'm not supportive of anarchy at the border. And I'm not supportive of this turnstile justice in big city America in particular for people that are here legally as well as illegally. The tens of thousands of violent crimes of class X felonies committed every year by people in this country illegally who shouldn't be here. And in many cases have been turned out and come back multiple times, as in the case famously of Kate Steinle, the young woman murdered in San Francisco by a guy who had been back and forth in this country half a dozen times at least. I will say again, for the record, if you do not deport people in this country illegally, first order priority, who've committed crimes, then I don't want to talk about Dreamers. I don't want to talk about migrant guest worker programs. I don't want to talk about anything, because you're not a serious person and you're not respectful of people's public safety interests. Everybody agrees with it, and yet it doesn't get done. That tells you there are other agendas at foot, and most of them are coming from the left, some from corporate America, too. But that's the left, I remind you. Len in Highland Park, here on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, Dan. We're waiting for you in September to come play golf at Briarwood. Everything's all done.
Oh, beautiful.
I sent you an email. I get a real simple question. Who's in charge of the people in charge? And it's illegal what the president is doing now. You know, between Hunter, the border, how do they get away with all this stuff? Whatever happened to the will of the people? And how can you do things blatantly illegal in front of the whole country and not suffer repercussions? It's very simple. Who's in charge of the people in charge? Can you answer that for me?
That's a great comment. Thanks for the call, Len. Look forward to Briarwood. I've never played Briarwood. Mm. Oh, be fun.
You and your fancy friends.
I try. Mm. So who's in charge of the people in charge? Well, I mean, the simple answer, maybe it comes across as trite as we are. So that's what November 8th is about, being in charge of the people who are in charge. I don't have a better answer for you. I really don't. It's imperfect. But it does give us opportunity. And I think you'll see enough people seize the opportunity to change control of the House and the Senate. And then we have our checks and balances. Republicans in control of Congress, conservative jurists in Republican appointees on the Supreme Court in control of the court. That's a pretty good check on the executive. But then you got to hold those Republicans' feet to the fire, too, because, per this issue we were talking about last week with the 17 Mitch McConnell and the 16 Quisling Republicans who got pantsed to some extent by Manchin and the Democrats, and to the other extent, they're just big spending D.C. Beltway creatures. Supported that $250 billion.
Oh, Inflation Reduction Act?
No, the $250 billion misnamed CHIPS bill that provide the leverage for the $750 million Manchin, Schumer, Green New Deal gambit, modified, watered down Green New Deal gambit, which we'll talk about a little bit later in the program with Christopher Whalen, the bottom of the 7 o'clock hour. But yeah, so you got it. But that's it. It's the same thing. Like, who's in charge of the people in charge of Illinois or Chicago, Cook County? It's just the same story. It's the same story. So this is why I say, you know, the time to be a wallflower is over, even if you don't like to rile up some people within your social circles. People need to be challenged on the merits as to what's going on. If first and foremost with people's economic security and physical security, probably in reverse order, physical security and economic security. Just, it needs to be challenged. You need to prompt conversations, drive people to either a position or an understanding, hopefully both.
You want more than just the headlines? Find out what's going on and what it means with me, Dennis Prager, this morning at 11, right here on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. You excited about the new election division, the United States Postal Service? Think that will lead to more fair elections, more accurate and swift counts?
They're so reliable. I mean, since COVID, has anybody gotten their mail on time? Anybody has daily mail delivery?
Well, I don't think they promise daily mail delivery anymore. The post office said that during the pandemic, it delivered 97.9% of ballots from voters to election officials within 3 days, and 99.89% of ballots were delivered within 7 days. Well, then why do you have the left talking about 10 days post-election to get your ballots in, even if they're not postmarked? You know, all the positions Joe Manchin, the great guardian of Western civilization, Joe Manchin and others were arguing for in the election federal takeover of elections before that stalled. The Postal Service is sending guidance letters to election officials in each state and territory this week, this coming week. They have gotten funding from the big guy and folks to stand up this election division and make sure that they hold up their end when it comes to mail-in ballots. Inspire confidence or generate concern? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. The Postal Service's position, of course, it will help the service better respond to issues with the election mail in every community. Every state's a little bit different. I mean, 8 states allow all elections to be conducted by mail, including California, Colorado, Hawaii, Nevada, Oregon, Utah, Vermont, and Washington state, just to name those 8.
Yeah, and here in Illinois, Democrats passed that law again that said ballots must be counted up to 14 days past the election day, even if it's mailed, if the mailed ballot is not postmarked.
Before the election.
Yeah, I mean, that's fraudulent.
And at the same time, you have the post office saying 99.89 were delivered within 7 days in 2020. Yeah. We're fully committed to secure and timely delivery of the nation's election mail. Well, of course, that's what they're going to say. You know, I think this varies to some extent state by state. And maybe you want to have a friendly chat with your postal carrier about this. See what they have to say. Maybe you have some people, you know, inside the castle that may tell us what's actually going on in advance of early voting, which, by the way, is only about 2 months away, first week of October.
So wait, first week of October, we have all of October, and then the first week in November.
30 days, basically, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. Who feels safe? Would you feel safe giving your mail carrier your ballot?
Well, I'm not trying to...
Being rude, I just, you seem very busy, preoccupied.
I'm not trying to cast aspersions on the Cliff Clavins of the world. I'm just saying that I wonder what happens at the union level. You know, the postal union, you know, they endorse candidates. They support candidates for office. And I'm not saying that translates down to how individual postal carriers do their job, but I'm not saying that it doesn't either. You know, there have been instances since I'm sort of on again, off again in this business of campaign activity.
Yeah.
You know, we've had experience dealing with the delivery of the mail for, you know, mail pieces. A lot of them are jumbo postcards, so you can see which candidate is being elevated or which candidate is being attacked. So, and, you know, you pay attention because you're spending a lot of money to mail. Pay attention to the turnaround time. You have people in whatever jurisdiction you're hitting, or if it's statewide around the state, that you identify to say, you're on my mail list. Tell me when you receive this communication so we know it's being delivered. And there have been problems.
Really?
I've had lots of problems over the years. Some of it I chalk up to just general bureaucracy, incompetence, lethargy, you know, that category of problems. Other things, other instances, I think there was a deliberate slow walking of particular mailings for particular candidates.
Was that in Cook County, in Sangamon County?
There have been statewide issues statewide. And I'm not the only one who's had that experience because, of course, you know, consultants communicate with one another. So I'm not making a general accusation or a specific one. I am offering you a general problem I've experienced and others have, and a description of the landscape that includes a public sector union that usually is not supportive of Republican candidates for office. So, you know, those are the sorts of conflicts of interest that actually Franklin Delano Roosevelt warned about with public sector unions. And we don't really talk about, but maybe we should, and fold this into the larger conversation about election integrity, free and fair elections, accurate counts, accurate and timely counts. Clay and Wheeling, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Back from my honeymoon in Turks and Caicos to annoy you guys.
Oh, very nice. Congratulations. Okay, yeah. How was it?
Oh, that is the best Caribbean water I've ever been to. Better than Jamaica, better than Bahamas.
I agree. I agree, but the food is awful there.
Look at you. Condé Nast corner here. You global travelers.
We're talking to him.
Have you ever kayaked in the Chicago River? That's nice.
That is a second to Turks and Caicos.
Exactly. Maybe, you might see a floating hand.
Maybe when you renew your vows, you can do the Chicago River. All right.
The shade of brown in the Chicago River is unparalleled.
Yeah. Oh. You can see the bottom really easily.
I understand where you're going, Dan, with election integrity, but I want to know why they are so focused on making this our main way to vote now.
Mm-hmm.
Why is this the key way to vote? You know, I could have understood it during COVID. You know, people are scared to go out and, you know, do this and that and, you know, propaganda and all that stuff. And people are scared to go to a voting booth. But why is this the main way to vote now? What happened to going in and casting a ballot? I always use paper ballots. I never use those machines. Why is this the main way now?
That's a great question. Yeah.
And the mailing system is a complete joke. Every year we're pumping billions of dollars into a failing system that's just run just about as well as Chicago public school system. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for the call, Clay. Yeah, no, I mean the whole, you know, 365, 24/7 voting for elections is
it's ridiculous.
The way we're trending. It is.
It becomes more vulnerable the longer the process takes.
And I guess the good news on some of this front is that you got rid of the Zucker boxes. The bad news is that you can do the same thing in a mailbox that you do in a Zucker box. So it doesn't eliminate ballot harvesting and other nefarious conduct, the elimination of the Zucker boxes.
And that's gone for good?
I mean, it's a state-by-state issue, yeah. Of course. Something else, too, though. I mean, so that's a bit of a concerning note just because it's hard to have much faith in, frankly, any federal agency. And the U.S. Post Office is certainly not exempt from that. And of course, you can't take the motivations of those who would fund this new election division, meaning the Biden administration, at face value, nor should you. Why? Because we know what they perpetrated and what they would like to perpetrate that they've been unable to, which I said earlier, which is the federal takeover of elections. So I think a healthy amount of skepticism should be directed this way. And part of that skepticism could be alleviated by a deeper dive into how this election division is going to operate. You know, pro forma letters to state and local election officials from the U.S. Post Office about this. That doesn't quite satisfy me. There needs to be like Republicans that whistle the Postal Service people before a congressional committee. And obviously that needs to happen before November. There needs to be a noise made so that that happens, because, of course, Democrats have control of the committees in both chambers. But there needs to be noise made by Republicans to get some deeper answers and to put people on notice that we've heard of the stories of slow walking. We know examples of election fraud. All you need to go is to do is to go to the Heritage Foundation website, and they've got a inventory of all the election fraud convictions over the last 15 or 20 years. So we know these things happen. And we know what the inherent conflicts of interest are. So let's talk about how this is going to be administered by the post office dealing with the various differences in election law in the 50 states. Philip and Skokie are on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yes, I think all the attention given to by the January 6th committee and all the constant talk of insurrectionists is to actually create an atmosphere hostile to any future rallies in Washington or even other cities of anyone who disagrees with the government legitimately. They never reveal how many people actually attended the rally on January 6th, but they're constantly harping there are people, anyone attending these kinds of rallies are insurrectionists.
Mm-hmm.
How can I go and protest the government now without worrying, A, I'm going to be labeled an insurrectionist or prosecute, or B, that there's not going to be a false flag group, a group of saboteurs funded with the federal, you know, the FBI and all the other guys who seem to show up at these things and then turn out to be phony insurrectionists. I'm going to get painted with that brush.
Well,
it's to teach the Americans to stop protesting your government.
Thanks for the call, Philip. That's an interesting point. You can't go to a school board meeting without being labeled a domestic terrorist.
Well,
frankly,
one, yeah.
I hear what you're saying. I mean, that is, there is definitely an effort to silence dissent. There's no question about that. I mean, in terms of protesting, right? I mean, you get labeled and caricatured and watch listed and those things. But I mean, with respect to January 6th, be peaceful and don't trespass.
Don't trespass. Real simple.
And comply with police officers' commands. I mean, take the route of Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement. Peaceful civil disobedience. But you're right there. I mean, we talked about this last hour, this British Army vet who's being arrested for, was arrested for a Facebook post.
Handcuffed and taken away.
For expressing his opposition to transitarian totalitarianism in the UK. Yeah. That is the attitude of the left. And this is why you see so many sort of center-left converts, particularly from academia, who are aghast at what those institutions have become and what the culture on campus is. And to some extent, I think you say the same thing in corporate America and many of our other institutions. So there is an effort to quell dissent, but that should make you redouble your effort to engage in the use of your constitutional right to petition your government. Keith in Evanston.
Kevin in Evanston. Good morning, Dan.
Oh, Kevin, sorry. Yeah.
Yeah, no worries. So I have a firsthand example of how the U.S. Postal Service is uniquely unqualified to handle anything out of the ordinary. So by out of the ordinary, I mean what they're designed to do. We had a my daughter's getting married. We had a special wedding invitation with some special stamps. We didn't want it, canceled by the machine. We wanted it hand canceled.
May I recommend Turks and Caicos for their honeymoon? Yeah. All right. Go ahead.
Right. Exactly. So it had to go from post office A to some other post office to get handled, downtown. And, half of the wedding invitations were never received. And, big organizations that are designed to do something systematically do that one thing well. When when they have to do something else, it's a disaster. And U.S. Postal Service is probably the least qualified in that regard.
That's a good point. Thanks for the call, Kevin. That's a good point.
It's a nice wedding invitation, I'll tell you that.
But yeah, they're big organizations are like battleships, right? They turn very slowly.
Good luck getting through on the phone line.
The United States Postal Service doesn't, the word nimble doesn't come to mind when you think of the United States Postal Service. And that's a really good point. Even if there is not any political bent or political agenda afoot, you still have just the competence issue, which I mentioned as well. But yeah, that's a good way to put it. Dan in Kenosha, Wisconsin.
Hey, remember when Trump was calling the virus the Chinese virus, and the liberals got all bent out of shape about it, calling him a racist, and anybody that brought up the Chinese virus, we were stereotyping, we were being unfair. Well, what do they think about the Chinese now that they want to blow Nancy Pelosi out of the sky? She can't even go on a trip if she wants.
Thanks for the call,
Dan.
Just don't
go to Taiwan.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You switch to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and let's get right to it because we have a lot of geopolitical issues to cover with our friend, Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, Vice President of the Catherine and Shelby Cullen Davis Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation, author of Brutal War, Jungle Fighting in Papua New Guinea, 1942. Jim, thanks for joining us. How'd you like the photo spread of Zelensky and his wife in Vogue? That's an interesting choice.
Well, it's funny you should mention that. I may have talked about this on the show before. I think this is actually something that's been going on for months. Look, I understand about Zelensky wanting to garner international support. I think he's jumped the shark. The reality is, it's particularly tone deaf in the United States, where there is a growing kind of partisan confrontation over Ukraine. And, I think not only is he overexposed, but he's going to a bunch of venues and places and everything, which are quite honestly political. I mean, Vogue is leftist in the United States. And so I don't think he's doing himself any favors. I mean, I think we've been through the crisis period. He's made his point. He needs to quit kind of putting himself and his wife out there as poster and get back to being the leader of the country. So I think from a marketing standpoint, he's doing himself no favors.
Well, why does he keep entertaining all these Hollywood stars too? Like Ben Stiller would come and Sean Penn was there at the beginning. And now they're giving tours. It just seems very odd.
I think it's a huge, huge mistake. I mean, I just think it you're feeding into this. Look, the reality is the left is supporting Ukraine for one reason, because Biden's their president. If Trump were the president of the United States, they would be the first people out there saying, this is Trump's war, and they'd be against it. And Zelensky, wittingly or unwittingly or not, he's really feeding into the partisan controversy that support for Ukraine is a political choice as opposed to dealing with a real national security interest in the United States. So, if he had called me and asked me, I would have, told him this, and he'd be way better off. But
Yeah. I mean, and especially against the backdrop of, say, one of the Ukraine's most prominent businessmen and his wife being killed in a Russian missile strike. This grain exporter was worth $500 million. Mm-hmm. Targeted by the Russians. If you're worth $500 million, I don't know why you're still in Ukraine, but nonetheless, that happened at the same time he's doing these sorts of things.
Yeah. Look, I'll tell you why they're still in Ukraine, because they're patriots and they love their country. There are 5 million refugees in at the height in Poland. Today, I think there's like 1.2. And when you ask, well, where did all those people go?
Back.
The overwhelming number of them went back to Ukraine, to their country. So we can, you know, we can talk about Ukraine and how and what an idiot Zelensky can be and everything else. And, you know, and we can discuss what's the appropriate role in the war. And we can talk a lot about how good a war leader President Biden has been. But the one thing we can't question is fundamentally, this is about Ukrainians fighting for their country with anything they can get a hold of. And a Russian invasion, which is completely unjustified, brutal, and has violated every single norm of armed conflict in the history of armed conflict.
Yeah, I mean, I don't dispute any of that. Yeah, of course, I don't dispute any of that.
Yeah. You guys, you know, let's go back to the corruption thing, which I think is so important, because yes, there is corruption in Ukraine. There is no question about that. Yeah, when you throw money at the country, it makes the corruption worse. The real criminal here is this administration, which just wants to write checks. This is not helping the Ukrainians by flooding the country with a bunch of money that they can't absorb and can't effectively use, and what makes it harder for people to govern. And you know what? I wish Zelensky would say that.
What about this proposal that's bipartisan in nature of sorts? To designate Russia as a state sponsor of terror, but that would freeze the country's assets in the U.S. And impose other punishments on Russia if that designation was so conferred.
I think there's probably enough gathering evidence to warrant a state sponsorship of terrorism designation based on the reporting that we're seeing on war crimes and other activities committed by the Russians. I do think that anything that cranks up sanctions on the Russians helps get the end of this conflict here sooner. The latest research on this, you know, people... when you look at the macro impact on the economy, not look how much oil revenue they're making or other stuff, you know, are the Russians kind of vacationing in Paris and stuff. When you look at the macro numbers, it's very, very clear that sanctions are having an impact. And so anything that has more sanctions on, I'm kind of down with.
All right, what do you make of, I don't know if you read the Daily Mail, but they're saying that Putin has an evacuation plan underway in case his army is defeated in Ukraine?
You know, the one thing I love about your show is, you know, every time I'm on and I tell you guys, if I don't know something, I won't tell you. Never press me. You say, okay, I don't know. I don't know the efficacy of the story and the origins of it. You know, it's, you see a lot of these stories. I don't know how much truth to, to give to it. I mean, every sign we've seen so far is, well, it's really, really interesting. I mean, the latest thing was, I mean, which really kind of worries me about Putin's own sanity, is, you know, they came out with this new naval doctrine. Well, we're going to put hypersonic missiles on all our ships, and we're going to drive the Americans from the seas. I mean, it's just like nut talk. And, like, where is that coming from? So, and what we've seen Putin's rhetoric and the reality of what they do on the ground are really two different worlds. One is a propaganda war, which may or may not have anything to do with what they actually might do. And it's about blustering, in addition to actually, you know, doing things like he said he was going to invade and he did. But the bluster has gotten bigger, even as their military fortunes have kind of are now, you know, ambivalent at best.
I want to get to some of our other partners in peace, according to the Biden administration, like, you know, Iran. The U.S. looking at sanctions that would target a United Arab Emirates-based businessman network of companies suspected of helping export Iran's oil, which is part of, according to Wall Street Journal, a broader effort to escalate diplomatic pressure on Tehran for that nuclear deal. Why are we having so much trouble with our partner in peace?
Well, because the Iranians think that Biden is a patsy and they want to squeeze what they can out of him. And so the Biden administration, much like certain people from a political party that are not Republicans who suddenly want to hire police because the midterm elections are coming up, they wanted to gently prod Iranians. Look, that's not the way to deal with the Iranians. I mean, the way that you want to get their attention, you hammer them like there's no tomorrow. That gets their attention. So, look, the administration doesn't have a plan B for dealing with Iran. The plan B is how can we get the Iranians back to plan A? And if they think these micro sanctions are going to move them in that direction, they're just whistling in the wind. Whistling past the graveyard or whatever metaphor works here.
All right. So CNN's reporting that Nancy Pelosi could be heading to Taiwan as soon as tomorrow, despite, you know, those angry military threats. One, why is she going? And do you actually think that they might shoot down her plane?
Does Paul have a stake in the Taiwan Semiconductor Company or something? Is that why?
I mean, why in the world? What is this political show for?
Well, look, I don't think they'll shoot the plane down. Look, Pelosi actually has always been a strong proponent of the security of Taiwan and its defense, in her defense. It would have, if they're going to Asia, particularly, it would have been awkward for her not to go. Hmm. Now, and then let's also talk about, it's a distraction from all her political problems and the insider trading scandals and everything else. And I do think she's trying to run away from that problem. And so she probably does relish this a bit because it does help distract from that. Look, there is no violation of norms here. This is no change. Newt Gingrich went to Taiwan. Former cabinet officials have gone. Senior U.S. officials have gone. Congressional officials have gone before. The Chinese are just moving the bar here. The notion that somehow her going is some massive escalation and some big deal, that's just nonsense. And our administration made it incredibly – all Biden had to do is pick up the phone when he talked to Xi and said, look, we've done this before. We're doing it again. The one China policy is our policy. It's not your policy. Go pound sand, you know, call me next Tuesday. And instead, he looked weak, and that's just encouraged the Chinese to look more aggressive.
Speaking of the Chi-Coms, doesn't look like we're going to be resurrecting the Monroe Doctrine anytime soon. Mary Anastasio Grady had a good piece in the Journal over the weekend, how China took Latin America. And she notes how Beijing is using the same kind of bait and switch they used in Sri Lanka all over Latin America and in Venezuela. Exactly. They lent Hugo Chavez some $50 billion backed by oil. Ecuador is working to restructure $5 billion in Chinese debt due in the next 3 years. Argentina has been especially notable for its open arms policy towards China, and on and on. And so we've got this Chinese communist presence in our backyard in Latin and South America. And as she describes, the State Department has been asleep at the switch, missing years of opportunities to correct the Chinese narrative that is somehow in the region to help these countries.
Yeah. And again, not partisan, not political, double-minded political party. But the reality is people have heard a lot more about the, you know, the backsliding in Latin America on democracy, escalating problems, and just the Chinese running, going to town. The reason why you've heard a lot more about that is since day one that Biden has been in office, it's been like a green light. So it's not just about – it's two things. One is it is about immigration and border policy that is escalating issues in the region. But the other thing is the Biden team, which is, by the way, the same as the Obama team, their policy since day one has been, well, they're leftists. We're leftists. You know, we should embrace them. That's what we do. But the reality is these guys are leftists in Latin America. They're also anti-American. And so opening up to Venezuela and Cuba and Nicaragua and all these other governments, we are accelerating our own self-destruction. You know, it's like the scene in the Ghostbusters, you know, when Gozer says, you know, name the way you want to die. You know, we're just stupid. And whether it's AMLO or anything else, is that this State Department, which is leftist to begin with, led by this administration, if you are a leftist, if you believe in Marx, if you think Che Guevara is a great guy and you wear his T-shirt, we're going to give you the benefit of the doubt, even though those people are the ones that are most likely to embrace the Chinese and most likely to stab the U.S. in the back.
I wanted to have you tackle a domestic issue that has returned. because you're a West Point guy, you're an Army veteran.
Right.
The PACT Act, which would provide health care and benefits for millions of veterans exposed to toxins from Agent Orange in Vietnam to
right.
burn pits in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Right.
And this is something that you had a lot of performative histrionics from
right.
the left about. Pat Toomey, the senator who has been accused of turning his back on veterans or leading the Republicans to turn their back on veterans. This is the yeah. accusation left. He was on with Jake Tapper over the weekend, and he explained the technical issue with the legislation that he has a problem with. It's not providing, obviously, the health benefits for veterans. It's providing a glide path to unaccountable spending in the years to come. Take a listen. Get your reaction.
One of the questions that I think people have about what you're claiming is a budgetary gimmick is the VA budgets will always remain subject to congressional oversight. They can't just spend this money yeah. any way they want. And from what how I read this legislation, it says that this money has to be spent on health care for veterans who suffered exposure from
yeah.
toxic burn pits.
This is why they do this sort of thing, Jake, because it gets very deep in the weeds and very confusing for people very quickly. It's not really about veteran spending. It's about what category of government bookkeeping they put the veteran spending in. My change, the honest people acknowledge, it will have no effect on the amount of money or the circumstances under which the money for veterans is being spent. But what I want to do is treat it for government accounting purposes the way we've always treated it for government accounting purposes, because if we change it to the way that the Democrats want, it creates room in future budgets for $400 billion of totally unrelated extraneous spending on other matters. That's what I want to prevent. We are spending way too much money to use to hide behind a veterans bill. The opportunity to go on an unrelated $400 billion spending spree is wrong, and we shouldn't allow it.
What do you say, Jim?
Yeah. Couldn't have said it better myself. It's exactly right. You know, I mean, it's just common sense. Why are they changing this? Right? If it's just about veterans, why are they changing this? Not to mention the whole thing. If you look at the legislation, this thing is so open-ended. Look, everybody wants to take care of veterans. I was in front of burn pits. I ran burn pits, for God's sakes, in the artillery for years. Nobody is insensitive to the environmental damage that happens and taking care of veterans. This is a typical thing. We put veteran on something and then you yell at people that they don't love veterans. But the reality is you're the one that doesn't care about veterans. You don't care about our service members. You just care about the politics. And these guys are so addicted to spending money, money that they don't know where it's going to come from, except they're going to raise taxes. I mean, you put all these things together, the inflation – fighting inflation bill, which doesn't fight inflation, which raises taxes, which just gives left more money to spend on left stuff, and things like this burn pit bill. And you realize that these people are literally out of control. And the closer they get to elections where they think they might lose political power, the more intent they are putting as much power in the hands of Biden as they possibly can and as much money so he can do as much transformation of the American economy as he can in the time he has left in his term.
Lieutenant Colonel Jim Caravano, VP of Catherine Shelby and Shelby Calm Davis Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation. Jim, thanks as always.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
America First with Sebastian Gorka. Today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Joe Manchin was on with our friend Brett Baer over the weekend to discuss the deal that he cut on a watered-down Green New Deal and to address whether or not this included tax increases, which it does, but Manchin denied that it does. First, Manchin explaining the timing of this deal that he cut with Schumer. By the way, you still need to get Kristen Sinema on board.
Right, and what's her position now?
The reports are that she is not in, and Senator Barrasso, who admittedly is a Republican from Wyoming, but John Barrasso is also saying that she's not in. So There's perhaps still one hurdle left for the left to clear on this.
In 2010, you said this: I don't think during a time of recession you mess with any of the taxes or increase any taxes. This bill does that. But here you are earlier this month.
You can't be raising taxes. You can't make anything inflationary. You can close some loopholes. You can find out where there's some things that should be done that should have been done before, but it won't be inflationary at all.
Now, technically, we're in a recession. And technically, according to multiple different organizations, this bill does raise taxes.
They're wrong. It does not raise taxes. And I've said this before. I said all we did was close loopholes, if you heard. First of all, in 2017, the tax rate, corporate tax rate, was 35%. It went from 35 to 21, 14% reduction, Brett. And when that did, everyone said, oh, my goodness, this is tremendous. All we're doing is basically saying the largest corporations in America that have $1 billion of value or greater have to pay a minimum of 15% to help this great country. That's all. I don't think anyone in West Virginia thought that anyone could get by with not paying at least their 21%. So we did not raise taxes. We've closed loopholes. That's all we did. And I made sure there was no tax increases in this whatsoever.
First of all, just a pet peeve of mine.
Yeah.
It's economic illiteracy. The corporate rate, cutting it from 35 to 21, is not a 14% decrease. It's a 40% decrease. It's a 14 percentage point decrease. And by the way, that 40% cut in the corporate tax rate is what unleashed so much of the entrepreneurial creativity and investment that had the economy humming along until we decided, much to the chagrin of reasonable people, to shut down the world's largest economy. Yeah, point of order. In terms of the $327 billion in new taxes that don't constitute a tax increase in Manchin world, Brett Baer pressed him on that with some of the scoring from organizations like Americans for Tax Reform and the Tax Foundation.
They say the proposed 15% minimum tax on corporate book income is the most economically damaging provision in the bill, reducing GDP by 0.1%, costing about 27,000 jobs. Here's Americans for Tax Reform on the energy portion. The legislation would impose a regressive tax on oil and gas development based upon emission levels of methane during production, leading to higher energy bills for consumers and higher costs of everyday products. Are they wrong?
We've worked with all those industries all the way through this piece of legislation on my side. All of my staff did. And when they're talking about the things they're talking about, that's not true at all. First of all, the basically deterring people from making investments, we've had the absolute massive record profits for the last 2 years and the lowest amount of investment in capitalism as far as capital expenditures. That's because people don't have confidence in the government. They're basically strangled by the permitting processing. We're accelerating permit processing. We're doing all the things we can to make sure that we can get things to market as quick as humanly possible, get production back up, bring manufacturing back. We've done everything humanly possible here.
The Wall Street Journal editorial board opined on the topic. Evidence is emerging the new Schumer-Manchin 15% minimum tax on corporate book income, especially harmful to U.S. manufacturers. Analysis by the Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation, which they note is hardly a nest of supply-siders, so unlike the Tax Foundation and ATR that were referenced by Brett. The Joint Committee on Taxation, Congress's Joint Committee, found 50% of the tax would hit U.S. manufacturers, which gets passed along. The book income minimum tax would hit the accelerated depreciation in the tax code that lets businesses write off investment in, say, new factories. So it has the opposite impact of what Joe Manchin is describing. It disincentivizes investment. It doesn't encourage it. The new tax increase arrives only days after the Senate passed a $280 billion subsidy bill for computer chip manufacturers in the name of keeping the U.S. globally competitive. And now Democrats want to take a chunk of that back for themselves via the minimum book tax. By the way, that chips bill is also a canard. $52 billion for chip makers like Intel, and the other 75% funding federal agencies. Stephen Miron, who's a former Treasury Department official, writing in the Wall Street Journal over the weekend, talking first about the $1.9 trillion back March of last year, which is about 9% of GDP in the last Biden funny money COVID-related bailout. The fiscal injection came as the economy was already reopening on its own thanks to vaccines, precisely when it was counterproductive and sowed the seeds of inflation that have now borne fruit. He adds, Senate Democrats took a flamethrower to a forest then, now want to put out the fire with a squirt gun. The details of this bill are terrible. The deficit reduction comes not from spending cuts, which would reduce demand, but tax hikes, which reduce supply. It will place further constraints on supply through regulations and tax increases, as well as redirecting resources via hundreds of billions of dollars of special interest subsidies aimed at Democrat constituencies. Think green energy queens, welfare queens, corporate welfare queens. All of this combines to exacerbate the demand-supply imbalance, and while the deficit reduction is concentrated at the end of the 10-year window in this $750 billion bill, the supply-distorting subsidies are granted up front, and we'll get to some of those supply-distorting subsidies in a minute. Christopher Whalen joins us. He's an investment banker, chairman of Whalen Global Advisors, also the author of Ford Men, From Inspiration to Enterprise, and the editor for the Institutional Risk Analysis. Chris Whalen, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy.
So how do you distill what Senator Manchin had to say?
Well, I think he had to cut a deal of some sort. The Democrats are desperate to show something for the last 2 years. They have nothing. And so, you know, I think he somehow or another got comfortable with this, but your analysis is correct. I mean, they're basically adopting a European model that says everyone must pay taxes, even if you lost money last year, for example. You know, companies are normally allowed to deduct losses against future taxes, but now we're kind of taking that away. You talked about depreciation for investment. The whole thing is just a canard, and I worry about people like Manchin, because they're the last of the Mohicans in the Democratic Party. The rest of them are crazy. Even Schumer is relatively moderate compared to some of these people.
That's a statement.
When they're gone, you know, we're going to be dealing with screaming lunatics that look like the far left in Europe. And I think the gap is only going to widen, guys. It really is. And you see the Fed, too, another New Deal organization, right? Let's have another New Deal. And everything they do creates problems. You know, I wrote a piece this morning about how there's no collateral out there. Why? The Fed bought it all. They own all the treasuries and mortgage backs for the last 2 years. Problem is, they won't sell them. They don't want the political damage of taking a loss, and it would be a big loss. And then, on the other hand, nobody wants these securities because they have such low coupons. They're very volatile. They're impossible to hedge. So you look at this and say, how is this helpful? You're telling us this is good?
Yeah.
And the entire world is screwed by this because we never talk about them. The single biggest factor in interest rates, the monetary policy, everything else for the dollar is offshore demand for dollars. We never talk about it. The Chinese are going down the toilet with the Belt and Road, all the things they've been doing. Nobody's paying the debt. You see the corporate sector in China, they've had a debt crisis for the last 3 years. You never hear about it in the media in the United States because they want to encourage people to invest there.
And the story out of the weekend, too, the real estate market is crashing there.
Yes. Well, that was the only part of the Chinese economy where people could play. There were lots of leverage, all sorts of extraordinary stories you can read online. Look at the South China Morning Post. They've been covering this. And you look at these cities filled with empty apartment buildings. This is communist command economics. And yet in the West, people get all warm and fuzzy over Xi Jinping, who is the worst dictator we've seen since Adolf Hitler. I mean, the guy is appalling. And yet Biden likes to do business with him. You know, Biden would do business with Vladimir Putin if he wasn't trying to destroy the Ukraine. So I don't know. We've kind of lost our way. There's such an opportunity for conservatives here, Dan.
Yeah.
There really is. A little bit of libertarian on the one hand, a little bit of common sense Main Street on the other. You know who this all reminds me of? Bill Gavin. You remember him? He worked for Bob Michael in the House. He wrote a great book years ago called Street Corner Conservative.
Yeah.
He was a boy from Illinois.
And yeah.
He knew about how to do this.
I liked him more than I liked Bob Michael, who was, a beltway creature. But I hear what you're saying. Well, here's the other thing, just so people know a little bit more about this. This, of course, since this is sort of a watered down Green New Deal deal, because this is, the word of the week is a transition. This is happening because we're transitioning from a world in which you can pay your bills to a world in which you can't. And so there's going to be some pain, of course. But
Electric cars that don't make any sense economically.
Well, that's where I was going. The electric vehicle subsidies, but the electric vehicle subsidies will not expand the electric vehicle market because of the caps they put on them, both in terms of income limit and price limit, but also where you have to qualify, you have to have automakers get their batteries, the component parts of their batteries, largely from the U.S. Well, those component parts don't largely exist in the U.S. So
nope.
The whole thing is to subsidize automakers for vehicles they're not going to sell.
Well, look, when you have a Congress that is so incompetent and so incapable of dealing with the most basic issues of economics and finance, this is what you get.
Yeah.
The electric car scam, for example. Well, we had all this hype around green. So we decided, well, we got to build electric cars. How do we do that? Lithium batteries,
mm-hmm.
which is about as backward looking as you could possibly be. Keep an eye on Toyota. Toyota is a very interesting company. I've known them for many, many years. They skipped this. They looked at lithium and they said, maybe for hybrids. But we really don't like the pure electric model. They're going for solid-state storage. And if they figure that out first, they're going to blow by Tesla and the rest of these guys so fast it'll make your head spin.
Oh, interesting. All right.
That's the future. We can't use lithium, guys. Lithium
is Toyota
bad.
Today.
Yes,
okay, all right, very good.
I'm just saying they are deliberate. Toyota is so conservative, and they often miss whole cycles. They just miss it. But that's good sometimes. And they tend to approach manufacturing in an extremely conservative way. So they won't commit to something until they think it's going to work.
Hmm.
Okay? The rest of this is just kind of treading water. I think 20 years from now, we're going to look back at the lithium battery age and laugh and cry, too, because we'll have to remediate all of these piles of lithium, which no one has figured out how to recycle.
Well, it's just so weird, because I was just recently in California, and a lot of electric vehicles, a lot of Teslas there, but there's lines for charging stations. I mean, they need to put the infrastructure in place, too, while they're developing, and selling all these cars. It doesn't make sense.
Correct. And you know what? I love electric vehicles. I wrote about it in Ford Mint. They talked about electric vehicles. They wanted to build them, but Edison and Ford realized that the technology was not there yet, and it still isn't. You know, it works for trains. You can put a diesel engine and a turbine on a train and make DC power. That's the way to go. It's the most efficient way to move weight, right? But to turn cars into EVs with a lithium technology, I think, is a sad state. It's political.
What do you think of the CEOs of American automakers like Mary Barra at GM?
Sure, they had no choice. The gun was put in their mouth, okay? Because you have this progressive cheerleading section. It's going, oh, we have to have electric vehicles. Well, yeah, but if you really sit down and look at the whole chain, the cost, the long-term problems, look at Ford. Ford has jumped in, too, and they've done a brilliant job. I like what Ford is doing, but I think they, too, are keeping an eye on Toyota because they know that if somebody comes up with a replacement for lithium, all of this technology is going to get flushed in a heartbeat.
What about a replacement for private ownership of cars like Klaus Schwab wants to affect?
Nah. You know, they could all live in the cities. We're going to have three or four blue states in this country, and the rest of it's going to be red.
Yeah.
No, seriously, because they don't seem to understand that they're losing this battle. They keep coming at this, and people over time will learn that they're worse off if they empower these people. We're having that fight here in New York. New Yorkers, believe it or not, are slowly realizing that the Democrats are just total buffoons.
Good.
But look at who we've got running for governor. I mean, please. You know, and it goes on and on. The mayor, Mr. Adams, total disaster. You guys in Chicago look good now.
I don't know.
Your mayor just fired another 200 city workers for not getting the COVID vaccine. And that brings the total to, what, 1,752? It's ridiculous.
One way to slim the payroll.
We still have a mask mandate on all transit in New York State.
Is anybody policing that, though?
Is anybody using it? Yeah.
No, listen, I still wear the mask on the train because, you know what? I don't care to share air with my fellow passengers.
Why don't you wear scuba gear then?
Yeah.
But last 2 years, look at the flu numbers. They fell dramatically because people were wearing masks. People used to wear masks because people weren't getting tested for it.
These masks are
ridiculous. They don't stop. The surgical mask, people walking around and still. I
think we should wrap everybody's head in cellophane.
That'd be a better start. I agree with that, actually.
But here's the thing. I mean, do you want to get on a plane with everybody with no mask?
Yeah, I
do all the time.
I don't care.
I don't care.
Yeah. Go for it.
That air is cleaner than in an emergency OR room.
Yeah.
You want to talk about clean air? That's the best way.
How do you feel about monkeypox?
I'm against it.
I'm also against orgies. So I think I'm all right.
Good.
Have you been hanging out with like Bill Nye the Science Guy or something? What are you talking about with this mask business?
No.
It's personal choice. It's your choice.
I'm 2 years into this and haven't gotten sick, so I'm great.
Yeah, well, me neither. And you know,
there's 26% of the world that will never, ever, ever get COVID.
Yeah,
and I think I'm talking to two of you right now.
Yeah, and I also
Ukrainian genes. That's what it is.
No, you have Ukrainian genes.
Oh, yeah.
Oh. Don't mess with them.
All right, very nice. So I wanted to get your reaction to this also, too, before we left you, just on the inflation piece, because this was sort of an excited utterance, not really falling in line with Jay Powell's sunny optimism as last week. This Neil Kashkari, who's the CEO of the Minneapolis Fed Bank, on inflation over the weekend.
It's very concerning. You know, we keep getting inflation readings, new data that comes in and as recently as this past week, and we keep getting surprised. It's higher than we expect, and it's not just a few categories. It's spreading out more broadly across the economy, and that's why the Federal Reserve is acting with such urgency to get it under control and bring it back down.
Is that what they're doing?
No. Neil is such a nice boy, but, you know, clueless. Look, if you read the transcript carefully, what you see with Mr. Powell is that he is a guy who is running scared. They don't know how to reduce the size of the Fed's portfolio without causing problems. And I mean like December 2018, September 2019, when the money market seized up. And unfortunately, you know, they're caught now. They can't go back. Even if you look at the numbers that the Fed of New York put out in a couple of research pieces last month, they're not going to get the portfolio down below $6 trillion. So what they're telling you is they're going to keep monetizing $6 trillion worth of Treasury debt, and then it's going to go back up to 9 or 10 by 2035. That's a recipe for permanent inflation. So, you know, these guys were caught off base. They were all singing the same song. Oh, inflation's too low. We've got to target 2%. Well, Neil should go to the library and read some Ludwig von Mises and some Hayek because they all predicted this. Whenever you go through a period of relative deflation, people always start whining about how inflation is too low. But now we got the opposite problem, and you got a world that's up to its tuchus in debt. So you're going to see restructuring in Europe. It's going to be ugly. Italy?
Yeah.
Forget about it.
Everybody should.
That's
Yeah. The
legacy of pretending that inflation's not a problem. And all of these people on the Fed board are guilty of this, including Mr. Kashkari.
Everybody should read Hayek and von Mises, by the way. Christopher Whalen, investment banker, chairman of Whalen Global Advisors. Chris, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Of the morning, Dan and Amy. We got all kinds of talented people retiring from the law enforcement business in Chicago and Cook County. We had this resignation letter from Jim Murphy, who was most recently overseeing felony bail hearings and grand jury matters. After 30 years as an assistant state's attorney, he resigned last week, saying, among other things, in his resignation letter, I cannot continue to work for an administration I no longer respect.
And that speaks volumes. And people there love him, Dan. They were very surprised. But he's one of 235 people who've left the Cook County State's Attorney's Office.
He said,
over the years.
How many mass shootings do there have to be before something is done? This administration, meaning Kim Fox, is more concerned with political narratives and agendas than with the victims and prosecuting violent crime. That's why I can't stay any longer. He said the office has been hemorrhaging talent from seasoned, well-respected veteran prosecutors to many of the younger up-and-coming ASAs. People are leaving in droves. It is clear as to why. It is not because of COVID. My plea to each of you is to keep your heads up and keep going. Keep doing the right thing the right way.
And then goodbye.
Then he was out.
Yep.
Somebody else who has recently hung up his jersey is Keith Thornton, who is a 911 dispatcher. And you may remember Keith. We've talked about him a couple of times for a couple of different instances of his professionalism, including the night that Ella French was shot.
Unit at Garfield and unit up the unconscious officer. Unit at Garfield and that's the unconscious officer, correct? Okay, is someone in the back with her? Is someone in the back seat with her? Okay, listen to me. Take that damn vest off right now and start compressions. Start breathing. Whatever we got to do, stop while you're driving. The officer in the back with her, take the vest off and start compressions now. You got the air.
7-4-6, compressions started almost 15 minutes ago.
Okay, excellent. Keep it rolling, baby. Keep it rolling. We got to come in. They know you're coming in. And units that are at UFC Hospital, have those doors open for me. Have them open, guys. Have them ready. Units in the crime scene.
And he's also been willing to be outspoken with respect to the city leadership and what's going on. It's nice to have people on the inside living this on a daily basis, like Murphy, like some police officers who've spoken out, like Keith Thornton, tell us what's happening.
It is essential that the police department take responsibility for the way in which it's policed and the way in which it has, in many instances, alienated people of color, particularly African Americans in this city.
What every other citizen within the North Side, the West Side, South Side, and downtown is feeling, what we've been feeling since she's been in office, that, hey, crime is here, and with these bills that they've sponsored and different things of that nature with these politicians, now she has her own secret little patrol on top of her regular detail patrolling her house. 71, I think, is the number, and actually she wants more officers on top of that. I've heard that there's SWAT officers at her house on and off as well.
Forget some of these aldermen. Maybe Keith Thornton should run for mayor now that he's retired. He's got some time on his hands. Keith Thornton, retired 911 dispatcher, joins us now. Keith, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Dan and Amy, good morning. It's a blessing to be with you guys. How are we doing?
Good. So what was your decision to retire? What was it based on?
Well, just stepping away. And that's the sad part. It's not even retiring. You know, okay. Like I say, even about the police officers in Chicago, when you look all around this country at these big cities that are super ultra liberal and have all these progressive things going on, these officers, as well as dispatchers, even firemen in these great professions who do wonderful work, we're not leaving the profession. We are just going somewhere else because we're tired of the nonsense, the corruption, and the cesspool that's being thrown on us all day. We're tired of it. We don't stand for it. So I'm not leaving my profession. I love Chicago. I love everything that I do, but I'm simply leaving this nasty entity because I refuse to stay a part of it with all that's going on that's not being told to the public.
Well, what would you change? What would be the first on your list if you were in charge?
The first thing, if I were in charge of the city, is number one, we got to get these politicians out of office, period. You know, it doesn't matter who comes to take over an administration or do this or that. If Mayor Lightfoot's in office and her administration, Kim Fox, if they remain in office, this city is gone. Done. So that's the first thing you have to change. You can bring the best people into office, but I have learned this, Amy. If you stay in a toxic environment for too long, you're going to become one of those toxic individuals, and that damn sure isn't me. So I'm stepping out, and, you know, we've got a lot of work to do, and I'm prepared to continue doing my community work and trying to make things better. I will continue being an advocate for these officers and first responders and city workers, but more importantly, the citizens. But I cannot do that sitting behind a set of policies that does not allow me to have my voice. And so that's why I'm out.
So talk more about those policies, because I remember this Facebook video. I know you've done a lot of that Facebook live videoing, but one in particular stood out from maybe a year ago or so, where you talked about the police resource deployments and where the gap and where some of the gaps were. I thought that was really instructive, because it's not something that I think most people not in law enforcement in some capacity understand what's going on. And that's part of the problem. So that as one example of maybe some of the policies that need to change, the amount of resources available and the deployment of said resources.
Well, let me tell you this. People say don't bring out the race thing, but it's very, very important that I do that. I am a very proud Black man, African-American. I love my country and I love my city. So let me just focus on that real quick, because my people are the people who are overlooked a lot. Right now, it's happening in all of Chicago, North Side, downtown, and different areas, people with money and different things like that. And it's bad, and I stand up for them, too. But what's happening now it's becoming and gaining more attention. But this has been going on for decades in minority areas. So the West Side and the South Side, you know, if you could hear the calls coming in, and we can't do anything. We're supposed to feed these citizens who are screaming for help, saying someone's shot right now. My grandmother's unconscious breathing. I'm sitting on phone lines waiting to transfer them over to an ambulance call taker, and it's taken 7-8 minutes while this lady's unconscious. And I can't do anything about that.
Well, about...
Well, he does do things, yeah. But the crime, when a crime is coming out, we can't send officers. So it's up there for 2, 3, 4, 5 hours waiting, and these people are calling back 20 times in a row, and now something catastrophic has happened to them, and it's all hush-hush, and that's wrong.
Well, what's the longest wait time? Because we know somebody was carjacked who had to wait almost 2 hours for a police officer to show up.
Yeah, Amy, 2 hours is nothing. You all you got to do is go to the citizens of Chicago. Before you have this information from OMC, you have wait times of up to 8 hours. 8 hours. I started the afternoon shift. We come in, everything's waiting way from the day shift. And we're talking about serious crimes. These are not just basic reports. These are people, females being beaten in the alley. This in progress, rape suspect at the hospital. And you mean to tell me by the time I can finally dispatch some of these officers to the scene when I first start their shift, they're like, hey, put a coat on it, squad. They're gone. The people left. And then you call them back and say, hey, are you still there? They curse me out. They say, it took you guys 7 hours. We just left. So with these whole statistics of crime is down, and the mayor and Superintendent Brown likes to throw out, yeah, maybe some of them are down week by week. You know why? Because a lot of people leave the damn scene after several hours, you know? So it's horrible.
There was this study, this report that was done over at wirepoints.org by Matt Rosenberg, looking at 911 calls in 2021, 400,000 of the little more than 700,000 911 calls last year were non-responses. In other words, no police was deployed to respond to the 911 call.
Absolutely. Same thing goes on in Chicago. You know, like I said, there's so many calls that go up, but too few officers. And because that happens and it's such an extreme backlog, you can listen to that radio and you will hear supervisors legit saying we're not going, throw a code on that. A code is essentially saying we're not going. We can't go. It's impossible. And a lot of this is happening in every district within the city. Start with downtown. But a lot of resources are deployed right to her house. They follow her around everywhere, right at her headquarters building. And those are officers that could be in our communities. There's 22 police stations in Chicago. That's 22 different districts, and they all need help. We're down 2,000-plus officers.
Well,
she's sick.
Yeah, what's the real total on how many officers she has? And is it true that she wants SWAT there as well?
Well, she has SWAT at her house. They whatever she wants, she gets. You know, there's no true number because it fluctuates. They're here, they're there. There's sometimes I'm looking at the screen and there's a battery in progress or someone fighting or a person with a gun on the same block. I'm looking at my map. I see one of her units out there. So I say, hey, unit, there's a battery in progress fighting right here. Can you take that call? Lady's getting beat. They'll come on the radio and they say, hey, no, we're assigned to this detail. We're assigned to this mission. We can't take that call. Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? So that call will stay on the board for another however many hours it takes for us to get an actual B card that's not assigned to any of these special missions that do nothing. And that victim is a victim. So how is that right?
So there's a couple of issues. One is you mentioned down 2,000 officers. So it's an actual resource issue. The other question is, even if you had 2,000 or 2,500 more officers, because of the culture, would it make that much difference? If you can't give chase in a car or on foot, if you're not going to stop, or you're not doing stops, and police stops are way down, if you're not going to entertain, stop, question and frisk, then what does 2,000 more officers mean?
You're absolutely right. You hit it right on the head, Dan. I just answered this in the very first thing. Amy asked, what do we have to do? It's to get every last one of them out of office. Because what you just said, if the work environment is poor, it's going to make it difficult for your employees to be productive, okay? No matter how highly qualified they may be, they don't have the backing. They're not going to feel that they need to do their job 1,000%. And every officer in Chicago, I mean, there's bad everywhere. There's little entities of bad everywhere. And I'm completely against them. The great officers are completely against them. Me as a dispatcher, I'm against bad dispatchers. But that's a very small entity. The rest come to work because they want to work. But when you have no backing, and when you go out there and try to do your job, you arrest someone, they sue you right after, or they're right out the next day, and then they're terminating things. Why would you even want to do anything? That's correct.
And
we need a new administration to back these officers.
And do you think that's the prevailing attitude of your colleagues in dispatch, your colleagues in first responders, both fire, paramedics, police?
Well, you know what? I won't even say that because I consider all of these first responders, fire, police, and EMS, as well as the dispatchers and call takers, most professional people ever. They're great. So I'll tell you one thing. We have gotten stepped on. We're so stressed out. Days off canceled, vacations canceled, a different period. We're tired. But when those calls come and we're assigned to it, they do a remarkable job because they always remember why they took this job. So I won't say that, because these people go out there and they do their jobs.
No, I mean,
and it's very, very hard.
Yeah, I mean the prevailing attitude about the politics and the political leadership, what you're describing, not questioning their professionalism.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, they all know this is true. And they respect me for saying it. It hasn't been easy. But a lot of the things that what I'm saying, a lot of them know it's true and they feel this.
Keith Thornton retired, well, not retired, just reassigning himself in his profession as a 911 dispatcher. Keith, thanks as always for coming on and continue speaking out. We appreciate your insights.
Thank you so much. You guys have a wonderful morning.
Thanks for all that you do. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. The great disintegration of America's great cities continues unabated. Here's another example of what we're talking about. It's not just violent crime. It's also the lack of respect for private property rights. Well, that's what happens when you have Marxists in charge. A two-bedroom, three-bathroom, single-family home is on the market in Portland's southeast neighborhood for $330,000. There is a catch, though.
What, you have homeless people in your front yard?
No.
Maybe on the sidewalk?
Your living room. Realtor.com, quote, unfortunately, there are squatters on the property. The seller does not have resources to remove them and is willing to negotiate the price for a buyer to take the risk of closing. And then expelling the squatters who've taken over this person's property. The neighborhood has become a hub of homeless people taking advantage of vacant houses, with neighbors stating that they now live in fear for their safety. Neighbors have started barricading unused doors in their houses, investing in security systems, and purchasing things like baseball bats intended for self-protection. You may want to upgrade from a baseball bat.
It's a little weapon. Yeah.
One resident, Annette Benedetti, it's unbearable to watch your whole city become a dumpster fire. Yeah. We know what that's like. Another resident, Dustin Shannon, it's a living nightmare. There's no peace of mind. There's no sleeping well at night. Every little noise, I'm jumpy.
Oh, my God.
Well, there's a lot of neighborhoods in Chicago that fit that description as well. But there's the great disintegration of America's great cities. And then there's what's happening in states and communities not lorded over by the new Marxists. For more on this, pleased to be joined by Scott McKay, publisher at The Hayride, contributor to the American Spectator, and author of the recently released The Revivalist Manifesto. Scott, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, Dan. Hey, Amy. How y'all doing?
Good. Portland and some other cities may be circling the drain, but America isn't, you argue recently.
That's correct. I mean, the thing is you don't have these kinds of things happening in the suburbs and the exurbs around these major cities. It's only the city proper, which is governed usually by hardcore left-wing nuts, where this kind of thing happens. Everywhere else, America is pretty much going on as normal, not perhaps in optimal fashion, but certainly in functional fashion. It's the cities where, the Democrats are in complete control, where you have crazy things like this. And you're going to start to see vigilantism in the cities. You're already seeing it in some places. You know, before long, there will be neighborhood militias and all of these other kinds of things. And a lot of our cities are going to start looking like Baghdad in more ways than one. But, that's what happens when things devolve. But the thing is people are leaving the cities as fast as they can. And so the Democrats they're ruling over ruins. The problem with ruling over ruins is that you don't have much to rule over after a little while, and we're starting to see that.
But don't you think homelessness has a lot to do with it? I mean, look, like you'll go to California. San Diego is no picnic. There are homeless people everywhere. There's garbage in certain neighborhoods. And then you go to places like Newport Beach, where if a homeless person tries to set up shop, they literally come by, pick up their stuff, pick them up, and they take them to Costa Mesa. Depends on who's
right.
in charge.
Well, it's like over 100,000 homeless people in Los Angeles right now. You get what you tolerate. And part of the project for the left as they govern urban areas is, they push, tolerance of things that people should not tolerate. And what you get is a decline in quality of life and businesses leave. I mean, I'm in Baton Rouge, an hour from here is New Orleans, which is, the devolution of New Orleans is kind of one of the largest untold stories in America. You have police officers picking up, leaving off the job, at midnight on a Friday night in the French Quarter, because there's 35 officers on call in the entire city and 40 911 calls on hold.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I mean, the whole city of New Orleans has like 430 active duty policemen. So I mean, there is no law and order in so many of these places. You have enough of this, and people are just going to give up. They're just not going to put up with it anymore. And
it's a good point you raise. That some of these suburban enclaves present other challenges in terms of the PHAT element, but you can say that, and this is an important point, and we've discussed it before, but it needs to be discussed more. The expectation in wealthy areas around Chicago, even those that are otherwise governed by the people with the same sort of mentality as the city, Cook County politicians, the residents will not tolerate what is happening in Chicago. And even those leftist politicians in the suburbs know that. And so there is no defund the police in the suburbs. There is no tolerance of homelessness or squatters' rights or any of this other silliness in the city, even when it comes to left-dominated suburban communities. It's interesting.
Well, and you know, there's an enormous amount of hypocrisy where this is concerned, because some of these same people that won't tolerate it in their own neighborhoods,
right,
will offer up all kinds of bromides about social justice in the cities, and everybody sees that, everybody gets it. I mean, at some point, the question then becomes, when are you no longer bound by this old political correctness, this, enforced politeness regime, and to start actually saying the truth about, what's being done in these places and how it's not acceptable. We're not there yet. I think we will be at some point. I mean, there are going to be some shifts in voting patterns that I think are going to necessitate this. We're already seeing it among Asian Americans. We're beginning to see it big time in the Hispanic community. And you're even starting to see it in the Black community, particularly with young Black men and particularly young Black men who are, upwardly mobile, are starting to look at the Republican Party some. And it's not because they like Mitch McConnell or Kevin McCarthy.
Right.
It's because they just look around and go, the people that run this place suck. I don't want to vote for them anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And if that means, voting Republican, maybe I'll do it. When that shift, which I think is starting now, is going to accelerate this fall and on into 2024, I think it's going to really be notable. That's where, and I write a book, you're about to have a political realignment that changes America out of this kind of New Deal, Great Society political era that we've been in since 1932, and into something else. I mean, it's either going to be AOC, Bernie Sanders socialism, which we're getting a good dose of now, and nobody seems to like it, or you're going to start to see a consensus in the country along the lines, not necessarily of Donald Trump, but something I call revivalism, which looks a lot like MAGA conservatism, with maybe somebody like a Ron DeSantis, or there's a whole generation of politicians coming up that, are setting a standard for, being pretty fearless about making conservative policy and fighting the culture war in a way that, the majority is actually on the side of the right. I mean, when Joe Rogan and Barry Weiss are on your side, if you're a conservative, then I'm not saying that it necessarily means you're doing something right, but it does mean the other side is so far out over their skis that they have really put themselves in a position to be a small minority.
I wanted to address a column you wrote, too, about Deborah Birx's book. We've talked a bit about her book with Jeffrey Tucker, but I don't think this book has gotten enough play in conservative circles, and I'm glad you wrote about it and selected most of the excerpts I would have selected as well, because Deborah Birx also hasn't gotten the profile she deserves, Fauci style, for her role in these unbelievably destructive, we're still figuring out how destructive, lockdowns and other COVIDian lunacy. You write about how her, and in her book, her admissions about her own dishonesty when it came to trying to work around people who are actually decision makers. She's an advisor. People who are elected are the decision makers. Work around the people elected to make decisions and provide misinformation or just not respect their authority and work around them to talk directly to governors and local officials.
I can't believe they even let her write that book because she was in a position to completely skate on the damage that she did. You're entirely reasonable to examine this along the lines of political agendas and intended effects. Deborah Birx, probably even more than Fauci, more than anyone else, destroyed America's economy in 2020. Writes a book bragging about it and bragging about the fact that she lied to Mike Pence and Donald Trump to bring this about. Now, Trump, maybe you can make the argument was a little bit of a victim on this because he was kind of a bit removed from it. Mike Pence has absolutely no defense for not having fired Deborah Birx no later than May of 2020. And frankly, I think it absolutely discourages him from any future in the Republican Party at all, because he was the guy put in charge of the task force.
Right, but what did he know at that time what did he know at that time, and why should he have fired her?
Well, I mean, this is the thing. How does he not know when Deborah Birx is going behind the task force's back, talking to governors and pushing a lockdown? How are they not checking up on the things that they're being told by people who were legacy public health bureaucrats,
right,
who were absolutely not, MAGA people? Okay. I mean, these were Democrats, loyal Democrats, who absolutely wanted Hillary Clinton to be president. And, how do you not do a top down review of that entire bureaucracy when you're supposed to be draining the swamp?
And when they finally bring Scott Atlas in to have a broader group of advisors, including somebody who disagrees with the heavy hand of the COVIDians, then she does everything she can to undermine Scott Atlas.
Well, I mean, the minute she started trying to undermine Scott Atlas, and I can't imagine Atlas wasn't complaining about it, she should have been gone. I mean, at that point, you run her off, and I know that it would have been a big media circus if you'd have fired these people, but that would have lasted a couple of days, and then you would have had positive effects after that. There's no question that what was done with COVID as the justification did way more harm than good. We all saw it coming. We all knew it was happening at the time, and it ended up costing Trump re-election because they would not have been able to get Biden over the finish line with the kind of tactics that they used if Donald Trump had the same momentum to his presidency in late 2020 as he had in late 2019. It was the problems with COVID. It was the justification COVID provided for all of those state election laws to be broken in those swing states.
And the economic impact. And the economic impact.
Absolutely.
You have these people turn around supporting these lockdown policies and saying, oh my gosh, he cratered the economy with these lockdowns. But you knew they would do that because they're completely unbound by their own hypocrisy. They'll do whatever. And they should have known better. There's just no question about it. It's just catastrophic decision making and management. But I completely agree with you. Even though she's going to make money on it, I'm so glad Deborah Birx wrote this book, because now we have things that we suspected to be true on the record. Scott McKay, publisher at The Hayride, contributor to The American Spectator, author of the recently released The Revivalist Manifesto. Buy Scott's book and just borrow somebody's copy of Silent Invasion. Scott, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
There you go. Dan, Amy, have a great one.
You too, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcasts of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.